Really, I'm glad to be here tonight. I've enjoyed the convention. I've enjoyed being here. I like coming to Florida. I've been here a lot. Probably, I'm sure people are tired of hearing from me, but I enjoy coming here. I got here because of a very, very bad rainstorm between here and Orlando last night. We got very bad, hard to get here. The cars and trucks were stopped and everything, so we didn't just got to the end of Larry's talk, but I've heard Larry talk at our group before, and I was enjoying him. I got up this morning to hear the Renegade Reverend who shared with us, and I was enjoying listening to him talk, and heard Nancy, who I probably unique in this group. I saw her when she came to AA. She was brand new. And she really, you know, people usually exaggerate how bad shape they were when they come to AA, but she doesn't. She was really a she was really a fat pig, is what she was. I didn't judge her. I'm just reporting what she was, you know. And something else she told you, she has a great distinction. She has the distinction of being the only woman I know in the world who's ever married in the Midnight Mission on Skid Row in Los Angeles. She and her husband, I gave her away. I was the best man. I was everything. The black girl that works for me acted as the matron of honor. And she threw some rice at them. And I wish she'd taken it out of the bowl. It would have helped a little bit. And a judge came down, a Japanese judge. Not Judge Ito, but somebody who looked like him. And a very, very nice ceremony. And I had to go away this afternoon for a little while. And so I had made a commitment. So I missed Dennis's talk. But I've ordered his tape. And I will give him more attention next week than I gave the other people I was here listening to as I drive the freeway. And tomorrow morning I know that we'll have a fine talk from our friend from North Carolina, who I've heard again many times. So it's really been a nice convention. I mean, we don't have Father Martin, but we have, you know, some AA members. You know, there's a difference when it says in the program, Father Martin, next year the first 1,000 will get here. And on this program, they said the first 250. Well, but I don't feel bad. And I want to join in and thank Fred. Thanks, Fred. Got to be nice to Fred. He hasn't paid me for my plane ticket yet. How you been, Fred? How's the family? Nobody cares. But from time to time these days, for some reason I cannot identify, I occasionally get waves of terrible gratitude, and I don't know why, and that's not like me. Waves of gratitude sometimes that I'm a member of AA and that AA continues to function. And it's amazing because I spent so many years fighting AA and knowing AA couldn't possibly fit me, and I'm sure there are new people in this room tonight who have that feeling. Because I came to AA a long time ago, and I came to AA year after year. I slipped year after year after year after year after year. The worst years of my life came after I was exposed to AA, after people were trying to help me, after people were trying to show me that there was a way out. And I became more and more estranged from what they were telling me, and I became more and more convinced they could not help me. I look back at my life, and I really could prove to the for some time after I was sober, not only that AA didn't fit people like me, but that I could not be an alcoholic. And I bet my life on it. And I really believed it. It wasn't a matter of defiance. It was a matter of really believing it. And I'm sure there are a lot of people like that. Unlike most of you today, I have an opportunity to see people like you and me die from alcoholism. And I see them go over the edge into irreversible insanity. And I see these things, and I want to just shake it and say, come on, it's going to be too late. And I have to remember, if it worked that easily, someone would have helped me all those years. And I came to AA, and I knew that there was something terribly different about me. And every speaker so far has discussed that feeling of difference, that feelings of other than, probably less than, which sometimes you mask under a veneer of imitation arrogance, but it really is less than. And I look back at my life, and I come from a little town up in northern Wisconsin. I've talked about a lot, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and when I was a boy, I like to look back as an idealized childhood, because it was. I was raised in a nice town, in a nice area, in a nice era. But I look back at my life, and I never really was very comfortable. When I was a small boy, if I had any facility, it was that of being able to read fast. I could read well. My father was a teacher, and my mother was a teacher, and I could read fast, for one reason or another. By the time I was in third grade, I was reading fast, and I was getting ahead of the other kids and getting to be a kind of a discipline problem, because I'd be done and bored and screwing around and doing things. And they didn't have special classes or special schools in the 1930s in little towns in Wisconsin. So what they did, they just shoved me ahead a year or a little over a year in school. And I went from the third grade to the end of the fourth grade. And I look back, that was one of the great turning spots of my life, without being victimized at all. It was just one of the great turning spots of my life, because I went from being kind of one of the bigger boys in the class, who was a captain of the softball and played basketball, to being the littlest boy in the class who nobody wanted on their team because he was too little, and always that kid in the third grade. So after that, seemed to me I was playing catch-up. I started really getting in problems after that, of being sent to the principal and years and on, always some kind of a catch-up, some dumb little insecurity. Then I was about 11 or 12. I was raised in this very strict church, which provided some structure for me, the Norwegian Lutheran Church, and quite strict, kind of like the Southern Baptist in a sense. And when I was 11 or about 12, I guess, my mother and father got divorced. And I'll tell you what kind of a life I had led. I'd never heard of a divorce. I'd never even heard of one, instead of seeing one. And my parents got a divorce, and my father married another woman, and my mother mourned till she finally eventually married another man some years later. But without missing a beat, I instinctively did the worst thing anybody can do. I instinctively did the worst thing. I'd never seen a divorce, never heard of a divorce, but almost instantly, without missing a beat, I began playing my mother against my father to avoid structure, to avoid discipline. When my mother would be on me, I would go and tell my father that she was talking bad about him, and I felt sad, and I wanted to come and live with him. And when she got on my case, I would go to her and say, "Dad, talking bad about you, and I want to live with you." And when they both get on me, I'd go to my grandmother, who sympathized with me. And since my dad's a teacher in the system, when I acted up in school, they'd say, "Probably it was because your parents divorced, wasn't it?" I said, "Yes, it was." And I'll tell you what happened. To all intents and purposes, I lost 3 years there, where I should have been turning into a young man, or at least a grown-up boy. And I stayed little in my emotionally. I just evaded everything. By the time I was 15, I was in deep trouble in school, although sometimes I got all A's, and sometimes I got nothing, D's and incompletes, depending on how I was feeling or how my moods were. And when I was 15, the Second World War started. And I thought, well, this will be an opportunity. I'll get away and I'll do something. I was restless and discontent. And I told my mother I wanted to visit my aunt in Superior, Wisconsin. So she gave me a little suitcase and with a few dollars for my bus fare. And I went downtown and hitchhiked to San Francisco. I had no idea where the hell I was going. Just a dumb little puke with a suitcase out there. Some guy that I knew gave me a ride outside of Minneapolis. I said, "I'm going to go to San Francisco." He said, "God, that's a long way, kid. Where do you go from?" He said, "This is the road." I think back about that now, and it just sends a shiver down my spine. I was a dumb, small, pimply-faced little puke, knew nothing. Any of my kids at 10 have known much more than I knew at 15. And I just hitchhiked, and the guy stopped. He says, "Where are you going?" I said, "San Francisco." He said, "So am I. Hop in." And away we went. From Minneapolis, for Christ's sake. And it turned out he was in the Navy. He was going to join the ship in San Francisco, and he just stopped on a whim. And all the way to the West Coast, we'd stop at trailer courts, and he'd get me a little bed, and he'd buy my meals, and we'd talk. And, you know, it must have been kind of a drag for him, but I thought that's the way it was when you hitchhike. You just tell them where you're going, and they take you there. That's for all I know. And see that you get treated well en route. And when we got to San Francisco, I told him I wanted to be in the Marine Corps and become a war hero and kill Japs like John Wayne. And he said, "You're probably too small to do that because you look very young." He said, "But the Merchant Marine is really crying for men. And I think they take people in their 16. Go to the Coast Guard office. Tell them you want to be in the Merchant Marine. Tell them you're 16. So he showed me how to go. I remember one of the golden moments of my life. I remember it clearly, almost as clearly today as I ever did. He put me on the Oakland Mole, which is a pier, and he put me on the ferry by about 6 o'clock in the morning, on a foggy morning. We went across this San Francisco Bay. I smelled ocean for the first time, and all foggy and mysterious. And out of the mist came San Francisco, the hills and the tall buildings. And, oh, it's like Oz, boy, I'll tell you. Oh. And I found out, I went up Market Street to find the Coast Guard office, and they were crying for men. They had me fill out an application. I put down 16. The guy said, well, you're only 16. We'll need your parents' permission, kid. So I took the application around the block, got my parents' permission. Brought it back. And I'll tell you, you think they weren't crying for men. They issued me seaman's papers right there without no training, just no nothing. And he sent me down to the National Maritime Union. And I walked down there on Montgomery Street. Some guy showed me how to get there. And they had me sign a waiver saying they could take union dues out of my check. And some guy took me to the Embarcadero, to a ship. And I got on the ship, and away we went to the South Pacific. And I remember standing on the deck watching all these people do these things. And we went by Treasure Island. I'd seen pictures of that because World's Fair was just over. That's where the World's Fair was last year. And we went by Alcatraz. That was a great thrill. I tried to see if I could see Al Capone or Machine Gun Kelly. Went underneath the Golden Gate Bridge, and the damn ship just kept going. And the earth was fading into out of sight. I had a feeling, I've mentioned many times, I think I had an intuitive feeling that I had made the first in an endless series of career errors. And I sidled up to some guy who looked like he was giving orders, and I said, I really appreciate this opportunity, but I should get back now. We have a big English test Monday. He wished me well. He told me to luck off. And somebody said, get to your forecastle. I don't know what a forecastle is. It sounds evil. Turns out, if you know what ships are, it's just where the crew sleeps in quarters, rooms. And I went in this room, and there were three of the worst type of people that any small, dumb Norwegian Lutheran puke could ever be with. And these kind of people are called men. And they just gave me, what the hell are you supposed to be? You on our watch? I now know why they felt bad, because, you know, I was going to be the fourth man on their deck watch, and they, when they saw me, they realized they were each going to be doing one and the third man's work for the rest of that ship. All I could see, there was a little tension in the air, so I told them some little stories that used to seem funny in study hall. And guy says, why don't you shut your goddamn mouth and get in your bunk? Well, I thought, I think I'll shut my goddamn mouth and get in my bunk. I had my bunk, and the ship was moving around, and I felt so bad. And these guys were talking about what they'd been doing in San Francisco. And I had lived a rather sequestered life. I mean, I sounded like I was a wild kid, but in those days, a wild kid would be like a campus chaplain today, you know. And I'd never heard of talk like that. They were talking about what they'd been doing with women in San Francisco. And they all had black hair. And I thought, my God, I've fallen amongst Catholics. I was shocked. I don't want to give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And I didn't know these pictures came to life on the waterfront in San Francisco, but I really felt terrible. And you know, I got to be just a whipping boy for these guys on that trip. I don't blame them. That's what I'd do if I had some dumb little puke like that. I was doing his work. I mean, they'd do things like, hey, kid! As the days went by, they'd say, hey, kid, get out in the engine room. Tell them we need a left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go up on the bridge. Tell the captain we need some elbow grease. And one day, they got me to take a drink of whiskey that I didn't want to take. And I never drank whiskey. Lutherans don't drink whiskey, I felt, and I never did. I promised my mother and grandmother I never wouldn't. And he gave me a drink of whiskey and made me throw up. And they laughed at me. I don't know anything worse than public humiliation when you feel inadequate, terribly inadequate. That's why to this day, I ask people I sponsor not to have handguns within reach. Because twice in my sobriety, I've seen guys in a moment of public humiliation grab a gun and do something they wouldn't have done if they had to walk in the next room to get it. It's just that instant craziness, and most of us are familiar with that. That's why to this day I ask people I sponsor not to have booze around where they can get it instantly. I mean, I know that they all say if you're going to drink, you're going to drink. That may be true, but I know that instant insanity that can sometimes happen. A good friend of mine in Nancy's named Eddie Regan, an old-timer, came home from a meeting. I had a hard day, went to a meeting, feeling pretty good, came home, went to the kitchen. Been sober a number of years, his wife grinding him, and the daughter in there. He's pouring a cup of coffee, Jesus. And he reaches to get a cup, and there's his wife's bottle of whiskey. He said, "Ah, screw you." Boom. And away he went. And if he had to go into the next room to get it, he never would have drank. When my daughter was married, my oldest daughter, we had a big champagne thing in the backyard of my house, and a lot of guests came. But the night before, I had that champagne in the garage. If I wanted to drink it, I could drink it, but I wanted cold air to hit my face before I got it. Because it's too big a risk to take. It's like playing Russian roulette. You can win 100 games. All you have to do is lose one. It's as though you never won any. But I was humiliated that day, and I wanted to kill these people, but I couldn't. And So what I thought I'd do, I'd try to learn to drink that whiskey. And all the way across the ocean, when nobody was around, I'd sneak into it, this bottle and throw it up and be so sick, and I hated it. I just, oh, God, I want them to accept me. And we got into Pearl Harbor, and they're still taking ships off the bottom. And there guys were on the rail watching everything. I was down there having a drink of that slop. And I remember that as the day before my 16th birthday. I took a drink, burned my mouth, and burned my stomach, and stayed down. And I couldn't breathe. And then all of a sudden, a significant thing happened. I discovered that when you drink whiskey and hold it down, you feel significantly better. I didn't know that. I thought, well, I can understand that. It might hurt your throat, but it makes you feel better. I mean, I've always admired people who have great insights into things, who can see things. I heard a guy a few months ago talking about, or a couple years ago now, I guess, about how he felt when he had his first drink. He says, though I'd gone into a new garden of experience, with many new buds and flowers and fruits to be sampled in the coming years. And God, I wish I'd known that. All I know is if you can breathe and you don't puke, it makes you feel better. That's all I know. Which isn't much, but it's enough. And as I like to say, you know, I would like to read things into that, but most kids in their teens, you don't think about things. You just learn things. That's when you learn things, you know. I don't know if it is how it is for girls, but it is for boys. That's where you learn things. When you're a little boy, you have crushes on girls. You may even like them enough to put their pigtails in the ink bottle in your desk or something. If she's sitting in front of you, and do hit them with snowballs and show them you care. But then you get in your teens and something happens. Your body changes. And now you feel lust for the first time. That's a new feeling. Then you learn about love. And then you learn if you're going to have any luck whatsoever, you've got to disguise lust as love. That's one, you learn that by the time you're 15, I suppose. And I learned about smoking on that ship. I didn't ever smoke, and nobody in my family smoked. But I smoked, and they smoked, so I smoked and puked. So one day I smoked and didn't puke, and I smoked every pack, 2-3 packs a day, every day for the next 45 years. Except when I was on electric shock treatments, they couldn't have matches. But I asked for them. I never gave up. You know, there are people in AA who tell you today that smoking doesn't hurt you. There are some of these people who are still smoking, and they say smoking doesn't hurt you. I'm telling you, as a guy who smoked two, three packs a day for 45 years, it does hurt you. It has practically made me bald. You know, Jesus. It's just, look around you. You can see the smokers. But I learned how to drink on that ship. I didn't pay much attention to it. Later in the war, I went in the Navy when I was old enough. And in the war, I was at the Naval Hospital in Northern California. And they passed around some tests, which I was fortunate enough to... I've always been able to read fast, so I did well on the test. I didn't even know what it was for. But it turned out it was some Armed Forces Institute test, and they gave me a high school diploma, the equivalency for it, which didn't seem like anything to me at the time. But I look back now, changed my life. If I hadn't got that, I'd have had to go back to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and start my junior year of high school. And I never would have done that. Never would have done that. I don't know what would have become of me. But instead, I went back and went to college the first year of veterans after war. And we all went to college and tried to look vicious and cruel. And got married in college, met this girl with black hair that seemed so, you know, in a small Norwegian Lutheran town, there isn't much black hair. And it just looks exotic. And when we got going together, she finally confided in me. She was a Catholic. And by that time, I was hooked, so I couldn't do anything. My grandmother just about died from shame when she found out her grandfather's going to marry a Catholic. But I married her, and my grandmother says that it'll change your life. And I said, no, it won't, Grandma. That's pre-war bigotry. It changed my life significantly, actually. Because I'm out in the world, I became a sports writer, which I like to do, but my wife was a Catholic, so she did what Catholic women do. She began having children. And I became a national distributor of small Catholics. That's what I did. I just, like a hunted animal. And all these years I drank, because drinking is the one thing that always helped me feel better. And I look back at my life and I see what drinking does for people like me. Maybe it's other people too, but I know what it does for me. Drinking has a special place in my heart because it takes a person like me who, of my own self, nearly always feels somewhat inadequate or not quite good enough. And when I have a few drinks, for a while, I feel more than enough. It takes a person like me who's lived with fear all of my life. Fear, not so much fear of physical things, although I fear that, but too a fear of exposure. People will find out I'm not what I'm pretending to be. I'm nothing. Really. But I'm so afraid of everything. But when I have a few drinks, I become fearless. I fight cops, jump out of balconies into swimming pools. Don't have a swimming pool? Shit, I'll jump on your lawn. Yeah. Takes a person like me that's so afraid of rejection, so sensitive, almost have my feelings hurt, so almost afraid to ask my wife to dance. When I have a few drinks, it all changes. You know, the best example I know, I must have said it 2,000 times, but I don't know a better way to say it. I'm sure it's happened to a lot of guys in this room, sitting at night in a bar, late in the night in a bar, having a few drinks, and watching an absolute miracle take place in front of your eyes. Watching some old beast gradually become beautiful. I might sidle over to such an old queen at closing time. Imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension. She'd like to join me in the old Chevy. Now, if she would say, no! God, if I were sober, I'd hang myself. I couldn't stand it. When I've had a few drinks, I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Too bad, bitch. Don't come begging tomorrow. That's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. And sometimes I drink too much. And well-meaning people then think I have a drinking problem. And sometimes I act bizarre. And some friends of my family persuaded me to go to my first AA meeting. What a laugh. In 1949. That's a long time ago. A lot of you little snots weren't even born. We love you. I should say this because sometimes I forget to say it. It should be said, you know. Young people, we sometimes take them for granted. But in my group in L.A., we have a lot of young people. And if you're young people, or like the young people in our group, I want to tell you something. You are the leaders of, you know, you're the leaders of tomorrow's AA. You're going to be the leader. And I'll tell you something else. If you're like the young people in our group, I'm really glad I'm going to be dead. What a bunch of boobs. One nice thing about getting old, you'll be out of here soon. But I went to AA, and I'll tell you, I found out about AA then and it stayed with me for that, because everybody in this room who's been here more than one meeting knows what AA is. AA has three major characteristics, perhaps. One, it's a place where people who have a drinking problem go and get sober. Then, after things level off, they return to God. And eventually, they show their gratitude by helping others. That's reasonably accepted, isn't that true? And that's nice, but that can't be for me. I remember one of the things, my early days, those first few meetings, I heard a phrase that sent a shiver down my spine. You know what it was? Man said he stayed sober by the grace of God. And I knew if that's how you stayed sober, I could never, ever stay here, even though I'm not an alcoholic, but even if I were, because I am a bad man. God's grace is not going to work for me. God's grace is for, seems to be for good people. There's no God's grace for evil sinners who have broken all the commandments. I remember years ago telling a new guy, I've broken all the commandments. I thought later, I really haven't. I shouldn't say that. I have never coveted my neighbor's manservant. It's not a hell of a lot, but it's a little start, you know. But I felt that could not work for me. And I wasn't an alcoholic. These people were alcoholics. You know, I drank, it was just terrible. Now I'm sober, it's wonderful. And I'm not like that. I'm not like that at all. And so I went for a little while and I left and I went to psychoanalysis and I went out in the world. I got a job in advertising. Finally, after I left the newspaper business, I got in public relations. I had to get better jobs. And all these years I drank and went to AA sometimes when the heat was on, because AA wasn't very well known then. And you could always convince somebody you were going to have a miracle cure. An employer would call you and say, we've been having trouble with you. And I could say, you know, I have a problem with alcohol. But I've heard of this new thing called AA. Now I'm going to try it. Well, that's good. I've heard good things about that. And it gives you a couple of weeks to think about things and make your plans. And you come home, same old wife, listening to the same old thing. I'm going back to A&A, Charlotte. Oh, that's wonderful. Maybe it'll work this time. We've heard such good things, man. They want me to taper off. Oh, okay. You know, there was no Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. God, since they started Al-Anon, there's never been a moment's rest for a slipper. I don't want you to drink it all. We're the program, too. We're the 12 steps. Boom! Shut up! Oh. Let me take you out to dinner. Here's a knuckle sandwich. You know. But I went to AA from time to time, and my life was untangling, and I wanted to be like those people, but it wasn't. I wasn't like them. Their problem was alcohol, and their recovery consisted of getting sober, returning to God, and helping others. That doesn't help me. And I worked it. And years later, I could see a pattern in my life that I never could see that I was going through it. But I was a pretty good writer, and I had some good samples of things I'd done. And in the creative world of writing, and like for advertising and so on, people always feel, you can always convince people, well, my last employer, he didn't like creative stuff like I know you would, because you're a creative guy. And I'd get a few samples together and I'd write a good resume, kind of skimming over some parts. And I'd get a job, they'd give me a job, and I'd bring my family in, pretty soon my wife would be pregnant, whatever. But I'd be working hard and I'd get to, and pretty soon, just after a while, pretty soon the job would start to get tedious and the people I was working for were dummies and my boss was a craphead. I didn't like the town and the neighbors were full of crap. And little by little, you could just feel that, and my drinking would increase. I'd have controlled it for a while when the excitement was going. And pretty soon either the drinking would get out of hand or my emotions would get out of hand or I'd explode one way or another and I'd lose my job. And the next thing I knew, I'd be in a new town, getting my samples together, getting that resume, doing it all over again. And I did this again and again in several cities. And I had some success. And I also left every town just on the run. And I have children born in different cities. But every one of them, in a way, we can look back. I look back at some of these cities now. For example, I had did well in El Paso. I was on the faculty of the University of Texas branch there. And I was working there in an advertising agency for some national accounts, I'm doing well. And we often look back and think, what a nice town that was. And I have to remember, if it was such a nice town, why did I commit suicide there and have to be put in state insane asylum in desperation? You know, just these things. And at the end of all these years, one morning, I thought I was kind of holding my own. One of these days, I'll find the town where I fit. I'll find the place where I fit, and it'll be all right. And one morning, I woke up, and two guys were throwing me out of a Skid Row mission. And about 3 weeks before that, my front teeth had been kicked out in a Phoenix, Arizona jail. And here I was in a Los Angeles Skid Row. They said, "Stay out of here, you damn bum." And I tried to explain to them I wasn't a bum. I'd been on the faculty of the University of Texas. I'm a famous writer. Ads that I wrote were running that very week in Life and Time and Collier's and Saturday Evening Post. But nobody cared. And my family was gone, and my home was gone, and my clothes were gone, and my front teeth were gone. And I stood outside of that mission, and I didn't know, how could this happen to me? I'll tell you, if a man were to come up to me, he didn't, but if a man were to come up to me and said, "You know, you've been going to AA now for a lot of years, and you've been in psychoanalysis and got to the root of your problems, and really made breakthroughs and discovered you've been victimized all along, and you've discovered the meaning of life, couldn't you think you might be an alcoholic?" And if my life depended on it, I'd have to say, "But I'm not. I'm not an alcoholic." And if he had said, "Well, why don't you think you are?" I couldn't have answered that. So I had to say something like, "Keep your nose out of my business," or "Leave me alone," or "Screw off," or something. Because I wouldn't have been able to formulate the answer, but I can look back and formulate the answer now, because I've seen it 1,000 times since then. The answer is this: because I drink like an alcoholic, but in some way I can't describe, I'm 180 degrees different from them. I've gone to a lot of AA meetings around the country over the years, and I don't know what alcoholics are. I don't know what AA is. So does everybody. It's a place where you go. Drinkers, when they drink, some of these people drink, and their emotions get out of whack, their lives get painful, and they go to AA and they get sober, and their emotions get straightened out, and their lives get comfortable. And I know that's true, because I've heard meetings in New York and Chicago and San Francisco and Dallas and Minneapolis. And here these people say, "Yes, I used to be a drinker, but now I'm back with my wife, maybe, or I have my children. Although I don't have my children back, but I've got a job, but I'm feeling better." And I used to sit and envy these people. "God, I wish I were like you. I wish I were simple like you. I wish I weren't so damn complex. But there's something different about me. I don't know what it is. But in some strange way, it's when I stay sober and try to stay sober, that's when my emotions get out of whack. And that's when my life gets painful. And I drink, I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink to feel the way they feel when they get sober. And sometimes I drink too much." And then well-meaning people say, "Oh, you ought to go to AA and get sober. You'd be all right." And you have to say, "Oh, thank you for the advice." But inside of you, the visceral voice wants to scream, "But you don't understand! That doesn't help people like me. My case is different in some way. I don't know why. There's something wrong with me. I'm dirty inside." But it was raining slightly that morning, and I walked 71 blocks out to the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax to a little AA club that I'd been asked to leave a few days before for being in there drunk and cursing and fighting. And they didn't want to let me in, but I went in there, and I felt just terrible. I felt like I was back on that ship somehow. And people, all these fanatics, all knew what they were doing, and here were these same old, you know. AA is a nice place for drinkers, but it's no place for people who think and can feel, because it's just so, you know, their solutions don't work for some people. And now they're full of AA fanatics. I don't know if you know what AA fanatics are, but they're the people. You know, I'm not a mooch. I've never been a mooch that I think of much. But sometimes when you have nothing, you have to communicate and let people know what you need so that you have they can help you a little bit at least. You tell these people, "You know, I'm kind of down and out now, but I used to be something. I have no place to sleep tonight, and I have nothing to eat, and I've lost my family. I have no place to turn. If I just had a little help to tide me over, I'm sure I'd be all right." You know what AA fanatics say? "Go to a lot of meetings, work the steps, it'll all work out." And you know what the answer to that is? You're number one with me, baby. Now, we're not going to start running for coffee every couple of minutes, are we? Well, I guess you've got the 50-50 tickets there. We have to be nice to you. Aye. I prayed to God last night that I'd win the 50-50. Now I found out this morning you're supposed to buy a ticket as well. Well, anyway, I hated it. I wanted to get out of there. I had no money. I couldn't think of anybody in the world except to collect phone call money. I'm sure there were people who would, but I didn't know who they were. I suppose every long-term slipper, whoever drank and slipped a long time and eventually stayed sober, has a tendency to look back and wonder what was different this time. Why did I stay sober this time? It wasn't because I wanted to stay sober. The only time I ever tried to stay sober, I tried to stay sober in Texas. I tried to stay sober there because in memory of my son, who had died when I was in jail drunk one night, and I felt so bad about that, I determined that never happened to one of my kids again. And as my drinking got bad in Texas, I went on the wagon, and I went to the psychiatrist, and I went to AA about two or three times, but didn't, you know, had nothing to do. Same old crap. And I tried to stay sober, and my kids, I loved them, but as I stayed sober, they became is noisy, intrusive screamers, and my wife's mouth was going constantly. I hated Texas, the wind blowing and the sand and the dirt and talk funny and crap, and these two jobs, and had a job in the daytime and a job at night to make up for the last blow up I'd had. And I needed to drink so bad I could scream. But you can't really drink when you've taken a vow on your son's casket. It isn't going to happen anymore. And so one day my wife was in the church with the kids, and I just pulled the car in the garage, hooked up a hose, turned the water, and went to sleep and died. I didn't know what else to do. Neighbor saw this happening, and I guess noticed I didn't come out. Came over and pulled me out, and I was dead, and beat at my chest, breathed in my mouth. And they rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me and talked to me, determined I was severely mentally ill, and transferred me to a locked ward where they interrogated me some more, gave me some tests, and determined I was a schizophrenic with severe paranoid tendencies and a dual personality, feeling persecuted, and committed me for an indefinite period up to the rest of my life in the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. Now that's how I get when I stop drinking, folks. Yeah. That's not much of an incentive to me. Oh, why don't you stay sober? Yeah, thank you very much. As I've said a lot of times, I'd like to go back and find that psychiatrist someday that made that diagnosis. He must be about 90 now. I could move him around pretty good. And I just grabbed by the shirt button and say, "You quack! Diagnosing me as a dual personality. You ought to lose your license, for God's sakes. If I could have got my personalities down to two, I'd have made it." Yeah, my problem has always been this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, and his eight brothers who come and visit. You know, I used to, a few years ago today, I used to hear a headline run of people who say things like, "I'm not sure the program's enough for me. Perhaps I need group therapy." Not me. I just go for a ride alone in my car. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. That's one of the reasons I drink. Because drinking reduces it to one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one voice. You know.
"Why don't you quit your job and punch that bastard in the face?" Okay. Boom.
It wasn't because I wanted to stop drinking. And I thought about that many, many times. What kept me sober? I didn't want to be what, didn't want what they had. I had wanted nothing. And I guess in retrospect, what happened was that I was so desperate. I was so desperate. Like being a kid on that ship, I was so desperate that I did things I had never done before. I let them, in a sense, send me for elbow grease and send me to get a left-handed wrench, equally inane, stupid things that I'd never done before, but they had me doing things, the dumb AA things. And I got a sponsor who got me to do dumb AA things. And over a period of time in my desperation, I took actions. And then I could give you a little step-by-step to talk about how I got better, but I want to, in case there are some new people here tonight, I want to tell you something. The best thing that happened to me that I can think of is that over little by little, very slowly, everything I knew about AA, AA is the place where you go and get sober, and you feel better. And then you, after a while, you return to God and get a different philosophy. And you show your gratitude by helping others. Little by little, I survived long enough to discover each one of those things were false. And if I kept believing him, I would die drunk. and I had no idea that was true. Probably the most important breakthrough was I never could believe I could be really an alcoholic. No matter how much I drank, been in jail 30-some times for drinking, but I'm not an alcoholic. It's a different type of thing. Because my problem is not really alcohol. It is when I'm drunk, but you don't understand about the rest of it. It's a deep thing that my psychiatrist can't identify. I can't identify. And I finally survived long enough and did things that enabled me to change a little perception of reality and being driven to do things to discover the most important single fact I know about my life that is still makes me feeling of gratitude when I remember it. I finally discovered what was wrong with me. Now, how could I be an alcoholic when my problem really wasn't alcohol? I didn't believe it was then, and I don't believe it is now. Because I discovered that's what AA said too. I couldn't believe it. I stayed here long enough to discover that's what AA said. In fact, I might go so far as to say that if your problem is alcohol, you're in the wrong place. You shouldn't even be here unless you're here as a visitor. Because we're not here to help people with alcohol problems. Doesn't that sound terrible? Sound like somebody's inner child has got the flu or something, doesn't it? But that's really true. Because if the problem is alcohol, detoxes should turn out recovered people. Hospitals should turn out recovered people. Treatment centers should turn out recovered people. Jails should turn out recovered people. And they don't. They turn out sober people with varying amounts of information on what may be wrong with them. But I'll guarantee you, if they be like me, and I presume like most of you, unless something dramatic happens after that, sooner or later they must nearly always drink or sedate again. In fact, that's the worst part of the illness. Well, if the problem isn't alcohol, what is it? Is it something mysterious they're not telling us about? Is it some, you have to buy new literature, you have to buy more videos, like in these other therapies? No. It's something quite simple. We know what it is. It's in this book many, many times. All of meetings, and people die from it by the thousands and hundreds of thousands without ever identifying it. The problem here is called alcoholism. You say, well, it's the same thing. Alcohol, alcoholism, same thing. Not the same thing. Considerably different. And unless you discover that, you may very well have a terrible life. And there's the differences are many, but put it in one sentence. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. In this strange, terrible, destructive thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually become so painful you can't stand it. The thing that makes alcoholism such a deadly disease is that sobriety eventually always gets more painful than the remembered relief of drinking. Well, even that doesn't make you an alcoholic exactly. It makes you, prepares you to be one, but you must be one of the 4 or 5 or 6% of people in every generation who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. Now, what is this unnatural reaction to alcohol? It's quite important to learn it. What is it? Makes you stay drunk all the time? That's what some people say, or I was a terrible, crazy person. Not at all. Some people do these things, but the unnatural reaction to alcohol is that it must have the power to almost instantly make everything all right. It's hard to think it's that simple, because that's something we take for granted. It's hard to remember 94% of people who drink alcohol will never know what you and I take for granted. When you drink, it makes things all right. And that is what AA is about. AA is not about stopping drinking at all. Stopping drinking is the entrance to AA. It's not the goal of AA. The purpose in alcoholism is to find some way, after you are sober, to find some way to ameliorate your life, to make a difference so you can live with it. And what you think makes you so different are the very factors that make you an alcoholic. I see people die today, they say, but you don't understand. My problem isn't alcohol, it's really... I have all these feelings when I'm sober. I just drink to get some relief. And they don't know. They've just defined the disease of alcoholism. That's why we do it. That's why stopping drinking. The natural state of sober alcoholics is growing depression and anxiety.
or as our book says, restlessness and discontent in nicer words. So somewhere along the line, I discovered there was a name for my condition. Whether I like it or not, I'm an alcoholic. And for one thing, I will never be able to drink alcohol again without having eventually. What alcohol does to me, it alters my perception of reality, and I cannot guarantee my behavior or my anything about it after that. It isn't as much you do bad things, it just changes everything. And that is what I'm here for. I remember when I was about 9 months sober, I felt so bad one night, I wanted to drink. And I thought, if I drink, I'll have to go back and I'll wind up walking down the street of Skid Row. Not even that doesn't frighten me, but the idea of standing there and not having anyone that cares about where you live or die. And you think, well, it's easier to stop drinking if you're on Skid Row. But over the years, I've sponsored a lot of people. I sponsored the guy that put the flag on the moon. I sponsored doctors and psychiatrists. I sponsored the guy, the director, won the Emmy this year. None of them are on Skid Row. What they have in common with me, they have a feeling that they could no longer stand sobriety and drinking was out of hand. And there you are. And you think that isn't serious? There's more sobriety in the United States than any place in the world. And there's AA everywhere. And it's estimated in America today that around 95% of alcoholics still die drunk or as a direct result of drinking. And they die convinced they're not really alcoholics because they can prove alcohol was not really their problem. And it wasn't. They only would have survived long enough to discover something called alcoholism. You are not so different. But I survived. But then we got to a bad part. Because now you have to return to God. You hear these people talk about God at meetings. And I, in my early sobriety, I couldn't bear it. I remember I used to say, don't talk about God. Because if God exists, I'm damned. If God exists, I'm damned. I've done terrible things. Terrible things. And especially in the Norwich Lutheran Church, God is not a loving God. It's bad. They'd say things like, well, God's grace will keep you sober. But I see a lot of people who can't stay sober. That infers to me, I infer that God says, you can stay sober, you two can't. You can, you three can't, you can't. God just somehow has some people stay sober and some not. If that's the case, I can't stay sober. Because God has never chosen me for any reward that I've ever been able to see yet. And He's not going to start now. And sure, these good people who drank too much, but not sinners like me, people who have done terrible things, caused people's deaths and caused people destruction and caused people to weep and a lifetime of hurting people without meaning to. How's God going to make this better? And I could not accept God. I could not return to God. I remember I got a sponsor who I thought would be a kindly good man because he has played loving roles in movies. It turned out he should have won the Academy Award for every role he ever played because he was a nasty, cruel, dictator, vicious. Well, I've said this before, but there were two or three times in my first year, I never had any money. But if I'd had the money, I tried to get the money so I could call the New York office and turn him in. I just want you to know, as an old timer in Los Angeles, killing newcomers. And I'll give you his name and address. I never could get the money together. It's all different now. It's 36 years later. When I talk to the World Service Office in New York, I say, no, I'm not. I've tried it both ways. This way is a little better. But anyway, I remember my sponsors over a period of time saying things like, you got to, but here's people talk about returning to God. I said, I can't do it. He said, can't you believe in God? I said, no, I can't. He says, can you believe in AA? I said, no, I can't. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? I guess you are. He says, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And he became my higher power, and I accepted him as my higher power, because he could not send me to hell. And I did things for that old fool, not out of love, but to get him off my back. And little by little, I took actions over a period of time, and I eventually came to believe in AA, my higher power. And somewhere along the line, I don't know how, by taking actions or doing things, the same things we talk about in AA, You take the actions and your perceptions change little by little. You don't know how. Some people have big breakthroughs. I've never had any big breakthroughs. They're just always kind of an osmosis. But I found myself one day praying to God. And I had come little by little tentatively to believe in God. And I've looked back at that many times because people say, how did you come to believe in God? And it's somewhere in my, when I was relatively new, early on sobriety. How? Because I had to find an approach to God that did not offend me intellectually, which sounds odd, but I just, not some thing like my mother and grandma said, oh, God will take care of you. You know, God won't take care of nothing. You go out in the street and ask for God's help, you see what happens, you starve, that's all. How can you accept a God that doesn't do anything for you, causes deaths, causes pain, causes, that's what God's love. Lucky Luciano lives in Italy, deported to the United States, drinking booze and have broads around all over, taking a little dope. And 50 miles away, the Pope, God's vicar on earth, dies screaming in agony from cancer. Is this how God helps people? I could not accept God. And I could not return to God. And little by little, I suppose over a period of time, when I heard speakers and I watched people operate and I did things. And I think what happened is this. I had to come, a couple things I had to understand. I mean, I had to start with this premise. If God is there, he must have the same, if God really is God that they say he is, he must treat everybody the same. He must love everybody the same. If he just says you and not you and you and not you, then there's no sense of God. I can get that anywhere. I can get that anywhere. But they say God loves everybody. Does God really love everybody like Chuck Chamberlain says? If he does, then he loves me. But how come I'm doing so badly then if he loves me? If he loves me the same as you, how come you're doing so well and I'm doing so rotten? How can that explain that to me? And little by little, I developed a concept that I certainly would not promulgate to anyone else, but it saved my life. And it's just this. I finally came upon a concept. I equated God, in a sense, to a television transmitter. Now, Channel 3, I was last night watching the basketball game in my room after the meeting, and that channel is sending out a clear picture all over South Florida, the Orlando game. And it's a clear, perfect picture. It doesn't care what kind of TV set you got, if you got a Japanese TV set or General Electric, whatever the hell you got. It's sending out a clear picture. And there's a lot of TV sets turned off. And there's a lot of people who don't know how to run a TV set. There's some that are screwed up TV sets and broken TV sets. But the transmitter wants you to have a perfect picture. And that's why you have knobs on your TV set. I mean, I've become I don't know how TV sets work. I know nothing about electronics. I have a son who's a computer engineer. When he tries to tell me about things, I send him to his room. I don't want to hear it. It makes my head ache. But I'm an authority on tuning TVs because, you know, I have little grandsons. I could be watching a football game. And I just turn my back or go to the can or something. And they come by. And I come back. There's a blue man on his side like this. And I don't know what caused it, but I know that horizontal hold makes him straighten up. And the vertical hold holds the picture. And the tint gets it back to the skin color. And I get a picture. I don't have to know much about it. And I had to equate God to that. That God loves me no more and no less than everybody else and any other human television set. And he's sending out a clear picture. Some people might call it God's grace. If you don't like that offends you, try serenity. Try peace of mind. And a lot of people don't even turn on their set, never find out about it. Some people get goofy sets. Some people get it all distorted like I did. And what Alcoholics Anonymous did for me is forced me into learning to operate the knobs on my own body. But the knobs aren't easy to see like horizontal hold. Instead of horizontal hold, there might be a prayer knob. I turn the prayer knob. I don't know what the prayer knob does. I could not convince you that any prayer I have ever said has ever gone out of the room in which I said it. I've never had any lightning flashes or miracle answers. I've tried it. One thing I've tried to do, and because I'm such a phony in AA, I have tried never to pray for anything except for knowledge of God's will for me and the courage to carry it out. But I pray for others, but I don't pray for myself because I'm such a phony about that. I don't know if any prayer ever got through. But I know this. When I turn that knob, the picture gets a little clearer. That's how I feel. And there's a knob that says, do what you can for people who can't help themselves. And it's inconvenient. I don't want to do it. I can prove I don't have to. I've been doing it for too many years. But when I turn that knob, the picture gets a little bit clearer. There's all kinds of knobs that I've been driven to turn in AA. And I've got a clear picture from time to time. It's just wonderful. I couldn't believe it. But unfortunately, through some sort of celestial joke, my TV set, perhaps yours, has seemed to have been installed in the back of a pickup truck. And every time I get that picture just right, it's an endless goddamn turning of those knobs. They just, how much longer do I have to do this? I've already found love. Shut up! You know. But little by little, I came to understand what AA talked about. Nothing in AA ever asks me to return to God or you. Nothing in AA asks you to return to anything, because we're coming out of sickness. It's like asking someone to return to pneumonia, only worse. It says you come to believe a new concept. You come to believe in a power greater than yourself that'll restore you to sanity, the ability to live in the world without having to induce psychotic drugs and alcohol. So you come to believe in something. And I came to believe little by little because I came to believe in my sponsor. And there were people in that group said, oh, that crazy bastard thinks his higher power is his sponsor. But I'll tell you this, if you're having trouble with a higher power, I would much rather have you believe in your sponsor that you do believe in than to pretend to believe in the God you don't believe in. Because you can fool him at 8 o'clock at night in those meetings, but you can't fool the dark at 2 o'clock in the morning. And you better have something you can turn to then. If you've been shucking them at night, you're gone. You get a bad way to go. I'd much rather have you have an arm you can grab and say, God, I'm no good, I'm worthless, than all the piety of praying and then going home and living in terror. But little by little, you change the actions here. And it turns out that's what happens in AA. Little by little, you change the actions. What AA does is changes your perception of reality. But I came to believe that God loves me, and he wishes well for me. And I screw up a lot, because I'm a human being, I'm an emotional human being. And sometimes I just don't feel like, I'm too tired, I'm too lazy to change the knobs. I don't want to dial the knobs, I've done it too many times. Why keep doing it? And on. Then I have to do it. And I haven't become a... Some people in AA, I've come to envy, because they've risen above humanity. They just...
I no longer have anger. I no longer have rage.
I'll tell you a little test on that one. Spill a cup of coffee on him after the meeting. See what happens. I did that once when I was new. I'm sorry I did it. I'd like to make amends to that guy. But I tell you that I'll get mad, so don't try it on me. But I came to believe that there was some... What was wrong with me? Alcoholism. I came to believe that God loved me. And I'll tell you, I can't tell you what gratification that is. Because for well over a third of a century, I have prayed to a God that loves me every day. And when my mother and father died, finally, we were quite close again by that time. I remember sitting in the Norwich Lutheran Church and thinking, isn't that wonderful? The same God is in this church that is in my meeting in West L.A. And I never would have known it. And I look around the room, and most of them will never know it, because they can still think spirituality consists of being somber and sour. They don't know that spirituality is laughter and love and kindness. And I need all of that. I need to remember those knobs. That's why I go to meetings. I don't go to meetings. I haven't heard anything new in an AA meeting in 25 years. That's true. But I leave a meeting every night with a new knob, a reminder what knobs to turn. Come on, let's get on it again. Let's get off. And finally, I discovered that you don't show your gratitude by helping others here. In fact, it's just the opposite almost. You help others. That's one of the big knobs. And as a result of that, you eventually feel gratitude. If you're waiting for your motives to be right, you may die. You got to act better than your motives. And that's why we have sponsors. Sponsors say, do it! Then later you take credit for doing it. People respond to different kinds of sponsors. Ray was mentioning this morning. His sponsor never told him what to do. But my sponsor told me what to do all the time. Because I suppose Ray
Well, he'd been a minister, he'd been this and that, and he needed to be rehabilitated in a sense. But I didn't. I needed to be habilitated. I never had been habilitated. Like Nancy this morning, too. I had never learned how to live in the world. I knew certain ways to hustle and get by, but I had no verities at all. I had to be habilitated. And I needed to take actions I didn't believe in because there were things that I didn't know how to do. I didn't know how to... I was learning... I think there's a strong truth can be made for that fact that your emotional growth, in a large sense, ceases to grow when alcohol begins to work for you. Because, you know, you no longer have to wrestle with deep emotional problems and conflicts. You can change them by drinking. And when you stop drinking, there they are. And it's tough. And I was still learning things in my 40s. I should have learned, as far as I'm concerned, when I was 15 years old, that I evaded learning. But I learned that you do what you're asked here. You try to be help to others. I've tried to be a sponsor to others. It's kind of a funny thing. Because I slipped so long, and because I've been sober a long time, people send me alcoholics. Long-term slippers around the country. I just got another one in from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And isn't that funny? His father's an AA. And I knew when he was a little kid, his father, and he's a rotten little kid, and he grew up to be an AA. Now his son's a heartache to him, so he sent him out to me. So I got this kid from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Reminds me of me. Simply smarter than I was then. But I wish I had something to transmit to him. I wish there was some answer. I say, here's what you do, pal. And that's it. Here's the answer. Wet birds don't fly at night. Never mind if the horse is blind. Keep loading the wagon. Okay. Yeah. Great phrases. Because it turns out I don't know any phrase to make it better. Because the only thing I know that will make it better is to change actions and do things even that you don't believe in for a while to make that surrender. I don't know of anything that is more difficult in Alcoholics Anonymous than surrender. Not surrender your things, but to surrender your judgment of what is right for you. I know you mean well, but you can't possibly know more about me than I do. You can't understand. You don't understand that doing that sort of thing won't help me. And that's why it's so ironic. This program has worked for people, millions of people like you and me. The last few years I've had the chance to talk in a lot of places in the world, in Berlin and Amsterdam and Australia and South Africa and Christ all over. And it's the same program, and the people always, in every meeting, in every big meeting, always there's three classes of people. Those who believe, those who are trying to believe, and those who are rejecting it and waiting to get out. And all of the battle is to get the in-betweens to go in the right direction. And it's that way all over the world. It's that way in your group. It's that way in my group. And that's why we have to remember to take time. I think it's an interesting thing. The last, when Dr. Bob was dying in 1950, and he helped him with the podium in that meeting in Cleveland, he wanted to synthesize everything he'd learned in his 15 years so he could leave something behind him. And the words he chose were as true right tonight as they are then. We must remember that Alcoholics Anonymous, let's leave the scientific investigations of alcoholism to the scientists. That is what AA is about. AA is love and service. We all know what love is. We all know what service is. That's all it is. And he said, secondly, we must never be too busy to stop and give the man behind us a pat on the back and a hand, because none of us would be here if someone hadn't done it for us. And thirdly, as true as ever, we must guard that erring member, the tongue, which causes more pain than almost anything. And certainly is true tonight in Daytona Beach as it was in Cleveland in 1950 or anywhere else. But the greatest thing to come to understand, I really, most of you people know all these things and probably ready to go to sleep, but to you new people, let me tell you one thing. If I do nothing else, contemplate that the things that make you think you're not an alcoholic may be the very things that mean you are an alcoholic, and your perception may be incorrect. And maybe, no matter how much you talk about it, you may somehow here stay around long enough for your perceptions to change, to come to understand that God loves you and means well for you. That's what makes me stop sometimes, and almost, not very often, because I'm not a very nice man, but sometimes sitting in the freeway jam in Los Angeles, all of a sudden I think, God really means well for me. If I just get my own craziness out of the way, I'll be all right. And it just makes tears come to my eyes, because I would bet my life I'd never find that in my lifetime. And then to pick up that phone and hear the hideous words, "Hi, I want to talk to you about my new relationship." You just want to say, "Mr. Immerstein, not in today. He go home a long time ago." And listen to who looked at me funny on the bus this morning, and why they're screwing me around at work, and why I'm secretly inadequate. My case is different. And do it again. I've always secretly resented people who have unlisted phone numbers, because I'd be dead if everybody had an unlisted phone number and I was new. So I pay extra to have my phone number listed in every one of the 7 books in Los Angeles County, because I don't want anybody to ever say, "You can't find my number." And it's a funny thing. Chuck Chamberlain had his phone listed. Bill Wilson had his phone listed. But some little puke in some backwater town has to have his phone on list because he's 2 years sober now. He doesn't want to be bothered. Well, better you than me. All I know is this. Years ago, when I was at that nut house in Texas, I got out of there by pretending to be an alcoholic, which I didn't believe I was, but I knew how to talk the talk because I'd been around AA for 7 years by that time. And when I came off electric shock treatments in that nut house, and they brought me this alcoholic ward, and at first, I never heard anything like this. I'd been to AA meetings, but this is the worst of all. I'd have ever been to Texas. That's why much of the South, some parts of Alabama, Louisiana, they don't say, here we say, "My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic." Everybody says, "Hi, Jim." But there they say things like, "My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it has not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any non-sedating or tranquilizing medication since my sobriety day. And for this, I'm truly grateful." Then they say, "Hi, Jim." I mean, it might be all right for some people, but when you're just off electric shock, it's... And I always thought if I ever got to be in a position of power, I would not subject people to some damn incantation. I would tell them the truth, whatever it was. So I'm glad that Fred has brought me here tonight to tell you the truth. Based on what I've come to learn in the last 36 and a half years, I want to tell you. Here's what I've learned. I've learned that my name is Clancy Immerstein, and I'm an alcoholic. And I've learned that through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it has not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating or tranquilizing medications since October the 31st, 1958, and for this I am truly grateful.